You're listening to The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe, your escape to reality.
Hello and welcome to The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe. Today is October 6th, 2018, and this is your host, Stephen Novella. Joining me this week are Bob Novella.
Hey, everybody.
Kara Santa Maria.
Howdy.
Jay Novella.
Hey, guys.
And Evan Bernstein.
Good evening, everyone.
Hi, Evan.
Hi, folks.
This is a rare episode because we are all physically together. We're all in the studio. So we are recording. We're also recording the video. So segments of this will go up online, but we're recording a regular audio podcast. It's fun. We like it when we're all together because then we actually get to look at each other and see each other, and the conversations are usually more fun.
But what we found out today was that the flood struck again.
Yeah.
It's not a second flood, but the damage that the flood did to it destroyed another camera. So this camera is bricked. It does not work anymore.
Camera number two falls victim to the flood.
It is a paperweight.
Did you guys hear about the, I think it was a female science teacher was using a meteorite as a doorstop.
Yes.
Oh my God.
And it turned out being a $100,000 meteorite. That's awesome.
Imagine if you have $100,000. That's like having a lump of gold as a doorstop, you know, when you're high. You don't realize that's worth something.
Wouldn't take much gold.
I didn't get the backstory, but you treat a doorstop, you kick doorstops.
But it doesn't matter. It fell from space. That's the cool thing about meteorites. Yeah. Like you're not going to mess
gonna
them
hurt
up.
It.
You know?
Yeah, you're right. It suffered space. It can handle someone kicking it.
That reminds me of the story. Somebody bought a rock at like a fair, you know, whatever, some bazaar, and he bought it for like $5. And it was $100,000 or something like that, $200,000 star sapphire.
But he thought it was like costume jewelry.
He knew what
or
it was. The guy who bought it knew exactly what it was.
Whoa.
The guy who was selling it had no idea.
All right, so is there any ethics with that or no?
I don't think so.
That's interesting. Yeah. I thought about that at the time. I'm like, gosh, so that guy, you know, this is worth $200,000 or thereabouts, and this guy's selling it to you for $10, and you talk him down to $5 for all.
That's true. It'd be nice to throw him a bone and be like, dude, you have is worth a lot of money. Let me give you $500 for it.
Yeah.
And then
then you lose it.
You buy it first.
Yes.
You buy it first and say, now that this transaction is completed and I completely own this thing.
And also, sign here.
Yeah. So this is actually worth a lot more than you think it is. So I'm going to give you $1,000.
Yeah, as a finder's fee.
Sure. That would be the cool thing.
That would have been the cool thing. Yeah. Maybe he did go back and do that.
But also, he's going to suffer some angst because he's going to be like, damn, maybe it should be an anonymous thing. One of the things you sold in the past month was worth more.
Was that going to help you? You're still going to think, what was that's going to even,
Bob?
That's worse.
I don't think it's worse.
See, but the thing is, a lot of these people it was like a yard sale or, you know, they're not like expert. Yeah, they're not experts. I mean, all these people that are experts in these material items, like you have to be expert. You can't be good at everything. Like that guy knew what a star sapphire was. Probably was
he was a mineralogist.
I feel like the flea market people, their expertise is picking out the experts in the crowd. I mean, like, that guy's really into that ring.
Right.
I wonder if I've got something here.
Right. Yeah. I wonder if you had any tells. Like, holy shit. Come on. He had some tells.
He had to.
Unless the guy was looking right
at
him.
He might have been cool as a cat. Though.
His eyes must have, come on. I don't think
so.
Yeah.
When he pulled out his loop and was looking at it, that maybe
at the very least, his eyes went.
The cartoon version went boing, 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 boing.
But he saw the rock that looked like a rock to the layman.
Yeah.
But it had that look of, hey, that's the outside of a sapphire. But he didn't know what the value was before he bought it.
He might not have declared.
Yeah. Like, you don't ever know what's in there, but he knew that there was something in there.
You have a pretty good idea when it was huge. Like this is a huge star sapphire. Wow. You know that it's going to be worth tens of thousands of dollars, if not hundreds of thousands of dollars. This guy's selling it for $5.
Yeah. That's amazing. That's why things like that make the news, because they don't happen often.
That's right. Although there was a TV show I watched, this was years ago. It was entirely based upon an antique expert who would go around to flea markets and buy really expensive stuff that people had no idea what they were worth.
Right.
So he would buy something for $20, $50 that was worth thousands.
Oh,
that was his career.
People.
That was his career.
And then everybody saw them on TV. That's their tell. They have a camera crew following them.
Duh.
What are all these lights doing here?
They want my Superman comic book. What? Why?
Yeah, because we're doing a TV show on savvy flea market sellers.
Yeah.
They probably have the guy go scope it out. They buy the stuff. Then they go and reenact it and say, hey, we'll give you $1,000 if you let us do a reenactment.
Show with people ripping you off.
Oh, gosh.
wouldn't want to be part of it.
So we're going to start with a what's the word.
Okay.
This is a special what's the word, though, because there's a lot of depth to this.
This was a recommended what's the word, because, Steve, you recently wrote about this word.
Yes, I was thinking that this would be a great what's the word for Kara, and then we could segue into the stuff that I wrote about.
Yeah, because when I looked up this word, which is epistocracy, which I keep wanting to say... What did I
get? Epistemocracy.
Epistemocracy. Yeah. I'm going to catch myself. Epistocracy. The definition that I found is quite different than what you were coming across when you were reading about it. So,
although I talked about that definition too.
Okay.
I talked about both definitions.
Does the word mean it's a society based on people's skin?
No.
Epi. Oh, no.
Think epistemology.
Yeah,
think
it's epistemology. It's epistocracy. It's the financial burden of words.
That would be what? Of words?
Well,
etymology.
You
know, that's what you're looking for.
Put that on your list of weird.
It has the same root as epistemology.
Yeah. Right, which is the history of a word.
No,
that's etymology. That's etymology.
Epistemology is the history of people.
It's not history of anything. It's the philosophy.
The philosophy of coffee cups.
Knowledge.
Of information.
Exactly. How we know what we know.
So one thing I found is that an epistocracy.
That word may be showing up in the.
I think it is actually.
What book is that
it's
you have there,
there
Steve?
Multiple times.
Let's see. Let's see. Go ahead, Karen.
Can't remember everything.
I bet you it's in there a lot, actually. And I do think epistemology. Wait, let me check. Epistemology. Look, it was word number 89. Jay was not listening when I did what's the word number 89.
I was listening. Yep. I just don't I don't remember.
Page 152 of the book.
I wrote that page.
So I did find that an epistocracy, which at this point we've talked about the roots, right?
Yes.
Ocracy.
They're a great band.
Ocracy from the Greek kratos. What does that mean?
It means to eat.
To rule.
To rule.
Right? So when we think of governmental systems, they almost always end with crises. They're all ocracies.
A kleptocracy.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Democracy. Mm-hmm. We may have heard of it. Yeah.
Idiocracy, the movie.
Idiocracy. And
wait,
of course,
oh my God, we're living the idiocracy right now. I didn't realize.
You're just realizing that?
Oh my God.
Wake up.
Oh my God. I'm woke. Heaven just woke me.
Wake up.
Sorry.
You are the Vince Vaughn character. Was that Vince Vaughn?
No,
it
dang
was.
It, you're
what's his
Wilson?
Face?
Yeah, it was one of the Wilson brothers.
Wilson.
Oh, I always mix them up. Owen Wilson.
Owen Wilson.
No,
it wasn't Owen Wilson.
It was the other Wilson.
No, it was the dark-haired Wilson.
Luke Wilson.
Yeah. I thought it was Owen Wilson.
Process of elimination. Right. No, Owen Wilson
is
the blonde
Wilson. You're right. It was who I got the last name.
See, I remember movie people, but I don't remember words.
So, and, you know, episteme, knowledge. Mm-hmm. So you put them together. This would then be a...
epistocracy.
A governmental structure where... who is ruling?
That controls information.
No, it's that the knowledgeable are the rulers.
Oh, okay.
The smart people are the people that are in charge.
It's always ruled by people who are in charge, but the people in charge are in charge because of their knowledge. Right. So
now, are they sharing the knowledge or are they holding on to the knowledge?
Well, this is where things get a little bit complicated. So let's talk a little bit about this. The kind of most defined definition is that it's ruled by citizens with political knowledge, or it's a proposed political system that concentrates all of the power in citizens according to their knowledge of public affairs. So whereas in our democracy, one person, one vote, regardless of your background, your intellect, your intelligence, your training, in an epistocracy, the people who are the most learned, their votes would either weigh more or they would be the only people who could vote. So you would start to see that certain people become powerful very quickly. Mm-hmm. And on its surface, it sounds like a good idea until you actually think about it and you realize this is a terrible idea. And really could be the root of things like eugenics. You know, a lot of this stuff comes down to who do we not like? Well, we'll just call them less than. Yeah. We'll call them intellectually inferior. So, but what I found is that an epistocracy is often classified as a type of, I think I'm saying this right, noocracy?
Noocracy.
Yeah.
It's an older term for
So that's like an aristocracy of the wise, but there are other types of noocracies now. There's epistocracy, which would be those with more political knowledge. Technocracy, which would be those with more specialized knowledge, right?
Skeptocracy.
Wow,
and of course, a meritocracy.
Meritocracy.
Yeah, is another type. And we often use these things, these words, in op-eds. You'll see them in political op-eds.
How about like AI-ocracy?
Yeah.
It would be a type of technocracy, right?
That'd be, well, a robot.
Oh, you mean where the actual AIs are?
A robotocracy.
A robotocracy.
That works.
Cyborgocracy.
It's got to be AI. Because an AI doesn't need a robot. Synthocracy, I like that. Synthetic intelligence.
Halocracy.
All
right.
Droidocracy.
So, yeah, so I came across this word in a slightly different context, but we'll get to that in a second. So the idea, when I was writing about it, I read about the history of epistocracy. There was, not too long ago, a recent book, you know, strongly promoting the idea of an epistocracy. And they brought up some interesting points.
Yeah.
Such as, well, we already sort of have that in that you can vote until you're 18. Well, why can't kids vote? Because they're not smart enough, right? They don't have enough experience, knowledge, maturity.
Maturity, I think.
But it's all of those things, right, that we say that children, aren't yet. But
understanding of their actions, yeah.
But it's not just because of their numbers, because we don't think they have the characters necessary to vote, right? So there is a criteria that we have.
For example, felons can't vote.
Felons can't vote. That's not in every state, and that's a little controversial, but that's a punishment. And then, but the other thing is that if you are a naturalized citizen, you have to pass a test to vote. We don't let everyone who becomes a citizen vote. We say you have to pass the civics test. You have to show that you're knowledgeable about the United States.
And if you were born here.
If you're born here, you don't have to pass
the
test.
You don't have to. And could you is another question.
Most native-born Americans can't pass the test. So they're saying all we're suggesting is, for example, we give the same test to all citizens that we currently give to naturalized citizens. So when you put it that way, it sounds a lot more reasonable.
Yes.
But I still think it's a terrible idea because just the potential for abuse is immense. Because once you break the golden rule of one person, one vote, then the people in charge can decide what criteria to use
for what people will vote. It's already happening. I mean, we're saying unless you have an ID, you can vote. We talked poll tax, literacy tax. Those were things historically.
Yeah, as African Americans got the vote, they started to impose epistocracy type thing. Yeah, like, oh, you have to be literate. Yeah, your grandfather had to be able to vote, whatever. And so we know what's going to happen. There's gerrymandering. You can't give the government that kind of control over who gets to decide who's in the government. I just think it's not.
Well, it's no longer a democracy the way we defined it.
It's something else.
Yeah, exactly.
Right.
Yeah, it's a great example of like something on the surface that seems fair.
You can make it sound fair, but you have to think about all the unintended consequences.
Right. Yeah. And the really intended consequences by certain people.
Yeah, some people might ask for generosity. But I came across the word, it was actually in a different context. And I was reading about how the Indian government is controlling what counts as knowledge.
Like fake news stuff.
Like fake news kind of stuff. And it was in the context of promoting ideas and alleged facts or history that promotes Indian culture. So the really extreme examples are, the ancient Indians, or the other precursors of the Indians, they had flight and they knew the speed of light and they had advanced technology. It's all rank pseudoscience. But that's a way of saying that of glorifying their own culture, and they justify it by saying, well, the West, their colonialism from the West, they defined our history and our culture on their terms.
Yeah.
And now we get to define it on our terms.
Yeah.
But what that does is it says all of science and philosophy is a Western colonial
conspiracy. We've heard that before.
Yeah.
And
therefore we could, we could tell our own narrative. It's just as valid as their narrative.
Relativism.
It's tough too because there's a place for that argument. There's a place for both of those things to be true.
You're right.
Absolutely, the narrative was written by colonialists and should be written by the perspective of the native peoples. Yet, we should also write it using logic
and
actual history. Yeah. Exactly.
It just so happens that Western culture was the first to hit upon really institutionalized, formalized science, right? And they also were a colonial power. That doesn't mean that science is purely a construct of colonialism, and you shouldn't throw the baby out with the bathwater, right? So yeah, you're right. Your history was written by the people who oppressed you, but science is still real.
So rewrite your history, but this is here to stay at this point.
Unfortunately, we see a lot of this, sort of embracing traditional pseudoscience based upon these kind of justifications. But there's even sort of a deeper layer there. It's the idea of not rule by the knowledgeable, but rule through control of knowledge.
Yes.
So used in that way. And not only by controlling what is a fact, but what even counts as knowledge, right? What even is the basis upon which we are deciding that something is knowledge and something isn't
knowledge? Like North
Korea. Like North Korea, right. Absolutely. It's like this gaslighting of your society. And so that's sort of, that's, you know, again, what's very upsetting about the current time that we're living in is that, you know, the whole idea of you could dismiss anything you don't like as fake news or as a conspiracy of those other people. The other, you could have your own sort of media channel where you get only the news that you want to get.
If the only way, we see it in China a lot, yeah. If the only way that we're getting our information is through dictated sources and then, oh, let's just block internet access right. to outside sources. It's very difficult.
Yeah.
So that's kind of that version right. of epistocracy. I yeah. just almost said epistemocracy again. Should be epistemocracy.
It could be. It probably. Yeah. Either way.
Do what I do. Just say it any way you want.
I know, right? Right? Yeah.
Is that what you do?
Epidermiology.
Epidermiology.
All right. Let's move on. All right. We're going to do some news items. Bob, you're going to start with a discussion of really ultra-faint dwarf galaxies.
How faint?
They're quite faint.
Yeah. A little bit of the ultra-faint yeah. galaxy.
So ultra-faint dwarf galaxies have been in the news lately. Basically, they've made some discoveries that revealed some details about some of these tiniest of galaxies. Dwarf galaxies, you don't hear too much about them. They're just not kind of, you know, as fascinating as huge spirals or...
They don't get any respect.
They really don't, but...
I mean, they're kind of hard to see.
Well, that's the problem. So,
how small are they?
That's the problem. Dwarf galaxies can be, they could be a million stars. The ultra faints, though, could be much smaller, down to 10,000. And,
our galaxy has 400 billion?
Yeah.
Stars?
Wow, that is
tiny.
So these are really tiny. But
are the planets, though, relatively the same size, or is everything smaller there?
But the interesting thing they only have dwarf planets.
Did you know that dwarf galaxies are the most numerous galaxies in the universe?
Kind of. No.
They're.
Yes, I did.
It's more common. I'm not surprised. So recently what happened, that one of the big news items for these class of galaxies is that using the Magellan Clay Telescope and the MegaCam instrument, they were able to look at these ultra-faint dwarf galaxies that were 16 times fainter than anything that they had seen before. So it revealed a lot of interesting new structures about these ultra-faint galaxies. So one of them was Reticulum 2. Great name.
Yeah, it's cool.
Like great
that.
Name.
Like what's
such
that
a
word
great,
mean?
A great, I don't know, but it just sounds awesome. It's like a sci-fi yeah. term, and you know,
it reminds me of Reticulitis.
Yeah, right.
Does that mean it opens and closes?
No. Yeah, but it's based on the constellation. That's the constellation.
Oh, okay. I see. Okay.
So I just love that.
Whenever you hear that,
yeah. like, gotcha.
It's always based on the constellation.
Interesting. Okay. Oh, that's cool.
So this faint galaxy was seen to be much more elongated than had been known, nearly 8 times longer than its wide. So this is just a kind of a smear of a dwarf galaxy, kind of an irregular shape. Takana 3. As it was another one with an interesting
name.
So these name.
Are, what cluster are they in, galaxy cluster or galaxy are you orbiting, do you know?
Oh, Milky Way.
These are all Milky Way.
These are local group yeah, galaxies.
Okay, yeah,
local groups. So, yeah, these are our, yeah, these are our.
How many
ours.
Dwarf galaxies of the Milky Way are there?
7. Sleepy, Topi.
So these are grouping galaxies. The last time I heard it was 57 or something.
Yeah,
like that?
I've heard around 60, and that some theories predict that there should be more. And I'm going to get into that a little bit later. But
so
but to yes,
reticular, net-like.
Net. Reticular. Okay. Yeah. I like it. It's so much better than 754-7. Mm-hmm. Like, I hate
so animals. Our plants are reticulated.
Yeah.
Yeah. That means they have like bands on them.
Was that the Chinese probes that went to the asteroid A1 and B2?
Yeah.
Or A1 and B2.
Oh, that was so boring. Yeah. So Takana 2 was another kind of smeared out one that's been tidally disrupted and is kind of flowing into the Milky Way. So they've seen these structures that they haven't seen before. Sagittarius 2 was another one, an ultra faint. A dwarf galaxy. That one is tiny as hell, 1,300 solar masses. That's crazy tiny.
Is it because it's within that constellation also, Sagittarius?
I would think that might be the reason. And there's actually some controversy whether this is not a dwarf galaxy, but kind of like an extended globular cluster. Mm-hmm. And we, you know, globular clusters
are these are conglomerations. These are star clusters. These aren't galaxies. There could be many hundreds of thousands of stars in these clusters, but they're not technically galaxies.
Is that because there's no galactic center to these star clusters?
They look like they have one. They have that very. They look like a dandelion through a telescope.
Yeah, well, they're globular. Yeah.
They're globular, and they're best things to look at through telescopes, I think.
Are they always merging and stuff? The stars coalesce.
Well, all right. So here's the difference, because you could have a dwarf galaxy that has a million stars, or these ultra faints can have 10,000 stars, but they're galaxies. Mm-hmm. Those are galaxies. Globular clusters could have hundreds of thousands of stars, but they're not. They're a globular cluster. They're a stellar cluster. Why? This has more stars. What's the difference? What makes it a galaxy and what makes it a cluster? What's the difference? That's a really good question. I'm glad I asked it. And so the reason is dark matter. Dark is dark matter. That's a huge reason why. There's very little dark matter associated with these globular clusters. There's a lot of dark matter associated with galaxies in general.
Do they all have a big black hole?
The dwarf galaxies, I've read no hint of a black hole. They're so tiny. So this is what happened. This is what happened. A lot of galaxies, there's filaments of dark matter throughout the entire universe. And those were seeds that visible galaxies grew around.
Those are the tentacles of Cthulhu.
Yes. So this dark matter was a seed for galaxies in general. So if you look at the cold dark matter model, though, there's something called the missing satellite problem, which is interesting because there should be a lot more of these dwarf galaxies in our local group, and we're not seeing them. There should be hundreds. The theory predicts hundreds of these things, and we're only seeing, 50, 60, 70, something like that. So it's a problem. Why is this otherwise successful model, cold dark matter, predicting this, and we're not seeing it? And this is what they're thinking has happened. Because very early in the universe, there was a period called reionization, when stars essentially lit up for the first time. And when that happened, it flooded the small baby universe with ultraviolet light and solar pressure, which kind of can push away gases. And it basically, if you were a small galaxy, you shut off. You basically, any stars that you had, you kept, but you didn't have any other new star formation ever since then, 13 billion years ago.
Because the solar wind was blowing away the material.
Yeah, and the UV, this period of reionization. If you were a small galaxy, so you have dark matter, you got just a small smattering of stars, you turned off. And those galaxies still exist. So the theory is that we're not seeing all of these dwarf galaxies like the cold dark matter model predicts, because it's dark matter with only a few smattering of stars that have been turned off, and they're so dim that we're not seeing them. So they're there. There really is no missing satellite problem because they're there, but we just can't detect them. So by detecting these ultra faint dwarf galaxies, it's showing that it's trying to support this idea of why these satellites seem to be missing. These satellite galaxies are missing. And when you look at these faint galaxies, it supports that hypothesis, because if you look at the age of these stars, you will find mostly 13 billion year old stars. The youngest stars are 10 billion years old. And that's it. Which is that if you're a galactic astronomer and you see that data, you're like, what the hell? There's no young stars? No young stars?
It's not making any more stars.
It's not making any more stars. So that is a huge support for the theory that reionization shut off these galaxies, and they are there like cold dark matter model predicts, but we're not seeing them because they're so, so crazy faint. So that's why learning about these ultra faint dwarf galaxies are important, to learn not only about dark matter, but also to get a good census of our local group of galaxies and the evolution of the Milky Way itself. So just a fascinating topic, bundled in these little tiny faint little galaxies, little ultra faint dwarf galaxies.
What did you say we detect them?
Hubble.
Oh, Hubble. Do you think once James Webb is up there that we'll see maybe more of these?
Oh yeah, absolutely.
We'll have to call them ultra, ultra, ultra faint.
So Bob, they're faint because they're small faint, and they don't put out a lot of light. But is there also masses of gas and stuff that don't have enough density to ignite that are just sitting there?
Some of them, I think there's not going to be a lot of gas there to form new stars, which is why there's no new stars there. So I think the reionization period of the early universe, I think, kind of blew away a lot of that gas. So you're stuck with what you had. And also if you look at these dwarf galaxies, there's no big stars burning there. Cause big stars have a lot of hydrogen to start off with, but they burn so hot and fast that they only last a few hundred million years. Mm-hmm. So if you see in one of these dwarf galaxies, with big stars, that won't make sense. That wouldn't make sense. And they don't have them. They're just old populations of stars with very low metallicity, which also lends credence to the idea that this is from the early universe. Because back then, the gases were kind of pure. There was not a lot of metals flying around because the universe was so young. So they're also like 1% the metallicity of the sun or less.
Now, Bob, I know that the Milky Way has absorbed dwarf galaxies.
Yeah, sure.
So could dwarf galaxies occasionally getting absorbed by their host galaxies explain why there aren't as many of them out there because they've been absorbed over the billions of years?
I think it would be a minor impact because cold dark matter models predicting hundreds of these. And I don't think hundreds. And we're only seeing like 50 or 60. So I think that's probably a factor they're kind of factoring in there because we've certainly absorbed a bunch of dwarf galaxies.
Yeah, James Webb, can't wait for that to go.
When is that? Next year, right?
It's coming up. I don't know the date.
It keeps getting delayed.
Yeah, they got some delays. It's beautiful. And it's 6 meters. I mean,
it's huge.
Hubble is like two meters.
Oh,
it's James Webb gathering capacities like that. It's huge.
But James Webb also has to be perfect because it's not serviceable.
Mm-hmm. Right. It's not like you can send a space shuttle.
They can't because it's going to be too far out.
That's going to Lagrange 2. We're not going to fly to Lagrange 2 to fix that. Yeah? That thing is like, that's like twice the distance past the moon. I mean, that's far away. They better not mess up. No spherical aberrations. No spherical aberrations, please.
No
kidding. Yeah. How come it's all blurry? Oops. we'll fix that.
I remember that. Yeah, I remember
it was so disappointing.
The nighttime comedians were having a field day with that.
It all worked out.
But it did.
Oh, yeah.
Wonderfully as well.
All right. Go to the image. So, Jay, is that wolf about to eat those monkeys?
Absolutely not, Steve.
Why not?
Why? What?
Because they're friends. Because they love each other.
What? Do they share each other's Facebook information? What's going on?
No, this is weird. This is happening, man. It's give peace a chance, dude.
And wolves living together.
Harmonious.
This is wolves and monkeys living together.
This is a quick one. It's just a funny little thing that's going on here. So in the alpine grasslands of eastern Africa, we see the Ethiopian wolves and the gelada monkeys. They've called the truce. They smoke them peace pipe. I don't know why. We don't know why it happened, but it's happening.
So, to be clear, they're not actually smoking peace pipe.
No, they're not.
Okay.
Or did they sign anything?
So the gelada are a type of baboon, and they have been observed to tolerate these wolves around them. And
do wolves usually eat monkeys?
Yeah, they would. Okay. Yeah, the smaller ones, the babies. Yeah. Like, you know, they hunt animals.
These wolves actually.
I don't know if these monkeys were like, "Ooh, they're too big. I leave them alone." But they'll eat their babies.
No, they'll hunt sheep and and goats that are the size of these guys. You know,
But they'll who would win in a fight?
I don't know. Baboons are pretty fierce.
This is Bob. This could be a whole new
wolf versus monkey. Now?
Wolf versus monkey, man. I would think that it would be pretty damn close because the monkeys are smart.
Yeah, but the wolves will hunt
and
in packs, right?
Dude, there are 600 to 700 of these, like 600 to 800 individual monkeys in this group that they were observing. So what happens is the wolves walk right through. They come in the middle of the day when it's the right time for them to feed on the rodents that they feed on. The researchers found out that the presence of the monkeys actually helped them, the wolves, hunt better. And over time, right, this didn't happen like, you know, it wasn't like a decision. It just kind of, they got used to being around each other. And now they're within meters of each other with not even a head going up looking at the wolf. Like, the wolves are accepted. They're cool. We don't mess with them. They don't mess with us. The reason that we like to talk about this is because this is kind of similar to, you know, where man first interacted with wolves. And then we began to domesticate wolves. It started with this, like this cohabitation. Like, it's okay to be around each other. And then more time goes by. They think that wolves helped early man, you know, early man, going back 40,000 to, you know, 11,000 years ago. There's a window of when we think we detected like the first domesticated wolf. So, you know, this relationship was going on longer than 40,000 years ago. But the domestication process happened by mutual benefits, right? So the wolves would help humans hunt. And then some of them, of course, would be predisposed to be nice or, you know, eat out of their hands.
Well, initially, the thinking is that the wolves were just feeding off of the scraps of
the human
civilization. And the ones that could get closer because they were less fierce, you know, got more food. And eventually
selective pressure, right?
Yeah, selective pressure. But you had a splitting of the population where you had a population of wolves that mainly was eating off the food left over by humans. And then there was strong selective pressure for them to be more adorable, you know, less fierce.
And their ears kind of start.
But then,
seriously, all the features.
Of course, it goes back to what was that experiment? The one, the famous.
Foxes. Yeah, the foxes. Yeah. But that also requires an active role on the part of human beings, right? So it's not just that they're
eventually
kicking, exactly.
But they got halfway there on their own, probably.
And there's something very specific about canid DNA that allows this, because we have plenty of what we might think of as urban pseudo domesticates, right? Like raccoons and pigeons and like things that
even
live harmoniously.
Yeah.
Yeah, that come up and they eat scraps and stuff, but they never developed and probably never would develop the kind of relationship that we have with dogs. And a lot
but
of people think
wolves.
It's because, yeah, they're pack animals too, right. That there's something about them needing an alpha or a leader that may have contributed.
Yeah, and I think, you know, humans have a natural tendency to want to interact with animals, right?
Oh, yeah.
I mean, most people want to see animals, and, you know, that's why zoos exist, right? Yeah. So I think it's natural, but to see a monkey do it is so cool. Like, this is pretty cool. Now, this isn't a new thing. This has been around for a few years that we've known about this. But I just caught my eye, and I just thought it was a fun thing to talk about. Mm-hmm. But the joke here is that this is the beginning of Planet of the Apes, though, right? Because if the monkeys... And the wolves form an alliance, and the monkeys start riding the wolves. And Evan, that's when we got to get the guns out. Because if they start riding those wolves, it's going to be like Lord of the Rings, dude.
Oh my gosh, we got that.
Yeah, the trolls on the wolves.
The monkeys are going to become the orokai.
The orc, yes.
So we're going to be in trouble. We got to watch out. We cannot let there be a monkey-wolf alliance.
Right.
Yeah, I mean, so that's more of a symbiotic relationship than a domestication.
Oh, sure, yeah, they're not really domesticating.
Close to calling that domesticating.
But it's the beginning, though. But
is it though? Or maybe this is it. So obviously the monkeys are probably, you know, having fierce predators around that are not killing you is a good thing, right? That means it keeps other predators away at the very least. Yeah. The wolves are getting something out of it because it's easier for them to catch the rodents. Maybe the monkeys also like having fewer rodents around. I don't know. I don't know. But there may be other benefits there as well. Mm-hmm. So it's a symbiotic relationship. Mm-hmm. But I don't know that it will go beyond that, though, necessarily, right?
We don't know. Maybe the monkeys aren't intelligent enough. You know, who knows? Maybe these wolves don't have the predisposition.
But now, if we were chimpanzees, I'd be worried.
Yeah. Coco. Now, Coco.
Gorilla.
The gorilla had a kitten, I believe.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yes.
But this is not uncommon in zoos. You see actually evidence of this all the time. It doesn't happen in the wild, but where a baby animal is ignored by mother, and so they'll give it to a completely different species to either...
Raise it.
I was about to say breastfeed. They don't call it that in the animal kingdom, do they?
Thank you.
Breastfeed. And yeah, you'll see all these like odd animal pairs in zoos all across the world. And it's freaking adorable.
I call that the dance. So we're at Kara.
That's why we so lost.
It's so funny.
You weren't there.
No, you weren't there.
One.
So we did Tuesday night of this week. We did our first book signing. Mm-hmm. And Steve's giving a really nice review of the book, like, you know, here's what's in the book, and here's what caused us to write it and everything. And Steve was talking about, it's kind of like the Gish Gallop, where they will go from, like, topic A, then you give them the reason why topic A is false. They quickly go to topic B, then you do it again. Then they go to topic C, and then they come back to topic A. And then when Steve said, you know, and then they come back around full circle, that's the dance. I call that the dance. It was just the way that he said it. Evan and I were sitting next to each other. He turns to me and goes, "We're going to make hay out of it." So we just keep bringing it
now and forever. The dance.
Well, everyone, we're going to take a quick break from our show to talk about one of our sponsors this week, Lego Technic.
Lego Technic is more than just bricks. It's real life builds with moving parts and realistic models that are challenging and fun.
Yeah, and these aren't kids' toys. Some Lego Technic sets have real working gears, electric motors, even pneumatics.
Yeah, Bob, so the one that I just built with Dylan, it's the rally car.
Ooh.
Yeah, so first of all, it's got over 1,000 parts.
Whoa.
This thing was so much fun to put together. And the one that we built, it actually has two cars in one. Like it has, so in one version that you build it, it's a buggy. And the other version, it's a rally car. And the buggy looks like one of those sand dune buggies from the 70s.
Cool.
You know what I mean? Yeah.
Sure.
And I got to tell you, this thing has like a freaking engine, like a piston engine in it that's moving. And it steers. Yeah. I know. I mean, if you could put a motor on this thing, you could use it as a remote control car.
Lego Technic is so real. And right now you can go to lego.com/technic to find your next Lego Technic build and see how Lego recently built a life-size drivable supercar out of Technic parts. Again, that's lego.com/technic, TECHNIC.
All right, guys, let's get back to the show.
All right, let's move on to the next news item.
And not insult any cultures.
No, I'm going to insult the culture.
Oh, gosh. Yeah.
Sorry, I spoke too soon. The traditional Chinese medicine. So the World Health Organization has included traditional Chinese medicine, a chapter on traditional Chinese medicine in its list of the International Diagnostic Codes, the IDC, or ICD, International Code of Diagnoses. You know, the purpose of that was to legitimize traditional Chinese medicine. This comes after about a 10-year tenure of the head of the World Health Organization was
Chinese.
Yeah, who was a strong promoter of traditional Chinese medicine. Mm. In addition, the Chinese government, you know, is strongly promoting traditional Chinese medicine. So, what is traditional Chinese medicine? Well, the picture we're throwing up there is like, that's the marketing thing. Oh, you think, oh, it's herbs and spices and
that
ancient Chinese
like,
writing.
It's all natural.
It looks delicious.
Yeah, that looks like when I go out for hot pot.
Yeah,
well, yeah, the Eucharist is in there.
Looks like what I ate for breakfast.
Yeah. Right.
But so what traditional Chinese medicine is the equivalent of traditional European medicine in terms of its legitimacy. And by that I mean like bloodletting and purgatives and urine color diagnoses and
bloodletting helped like a couple of people. There was one thing that you could have that bloodletting helped.
Yeah. Polycythemia. Right.
That's it. Yeah, maybe one
blood.
Person.
Too much red blood.
Yeah.
Helps when you have too much blood.
Yeah. Worked for that guy.
These are the people that eat shark fin soup.
But yeah, worse than that. I mean, it's based upon, I mean, if you read the article, you know, it's based upon, there was a Nature article discussing this, and they tried to take a balanced view. It was like the worst false balance. It was puke-inducing. Because, some people are concerned that it'll be promoting things that are not quite scientific or that haven't been tested. That's not the problem.
Gosh.
The problem is that it hasn't been tested. The problem is it's pseudoscience from beginning to end. And to the degree that it has been tested, it doesn't work. So, for example, a lot of the core of traditional Chinese medicine is based upon the idea of qi, of magical life energy, which does not exist, of yin and yang, you know, sort of pushing and pulling of the forces. And, like acupuncture is based upon that. Acupoints, you know, are based upon Chinese astrology.
What's the one where they just Reiki?
That's Japanese, but that's still, it's still life. It's qi.
It's the force, yeah.
Yeah, it's still moving the force around.
It's the force.
Yeah, and so there's no evidence that any of this works, and it's all the equivalent of bloodletting in Europe, you know, from 1,000 years ago, up until it was replaced by science-based medicine, right? Mm-hmm. Scientific medicine.
Well, when you say replaced,
it was.
It's still there, all this.
Bloodletting. I'm talking about the bloodletting.
Oh, yeah.
I'm talking about in Europe, it was, in the West, it was replaced. We were just talking about this fact. This happens to be that, that's the culture that developed science first. And then actually, Occidental culture goes back to the Greeks.
Yeah.
And then, the Persians actually carried the torch for a while. But it landed in, in Western culture. And that was the first culture to like institutionalize science-based medicine, right? And every other culture at that time was just using a mix of things, mainly traditional.
It wasn't like a quick flip, though.
Well,
like there was holdovers for sure.
There was definitely it was a slow process. And then in 1910, the Flexner Report, or it was like flipping a switch in that, at least in the United States, it was like, all right, all medical schools have to be science-based now. And then half of them literally shut down. And then only half of them survived. And so that was like, if you had to say a date when we officially became a science-based profession, it was 1910.
So that's not that long ago. I mean,
that's 100 years.
That's
100
years. That's a year to celebrate. I didn't think of it that way.
It's a little bit over 100 years ago. They talk about, in the Nature article, like with a complete absence of outrage, which is always the thing that gets me outraged.
Nature. This is Nature.
Yeah, this is. I mean, the Nature. There was a lot of skepticism in there, but again, they were trying to take this balanced view. It was all
well. They probably were also trying to make sure that they didn't insult readers that they needed to reach.
But they like with a straight face, they write that without a hint of irony. So like the traditional Chinese medicine might diagnose you with an excess of heat and therefore prescribe something that would reduce if you had too much water, let's say for example that you were peeing all the time, they would diagnose that as an excess of heat and they would diagnose some herb or something. Whereas Western doctors might diagnose you with diabetes. Think about that for a minute. Yeah, if you're peeing a lot because you're spilling glucose into your urine because you have blood sugars in excess of 500, 600, 700, yes, we probably are going to diagnose you with diabetes and treat you with drugs, with diet, exercise, insulin in the short term.
Things that help you not die.
Yeah, like things that will keep you from dying in the short term and, you know, and keep you from getting all the horrible complications of diabetes in the long run. This is the result of a lot of scientific research, of a hard-won process of trying to figure out how the body works and then how do we intervene when things go wrong. But we're going to forget all that knowledge and we're going to use something that people came up with 1,000 years ago based upon absolutely zero knowledge about how the body works, based upon superstition. And that doesn't work. That objectively does not work.
Yeah,
and
based on really,
and they're presented this as like, these are two different choices. You know, and the World Health Organization said, this is legitimate too. You know, so we're going to now.
Pick your poison.
The hell?
It's frustrating because working on my PhD now in psychology, I'm hearing a lot of like mixed perspectives about the argument of science-based mental health approaches, right? Because the medical model doesn't always apply as easily to psychology. Yeah. It just doesn't. It usually does in certain aspects, but in other aspects, I hear a lot about like the contextual model, which is like taking in what we know about neurobiology and medicine, but also always trying to be understanding and empathic about somebody's cultural viewpoint. Because of course, when it comes to mental health and healing, if you talk to somebody from their own cultural perspective, you're going to be more effective at reaching them and healing them. And so it feels almost like this necessary, legitimate, I think from a good place argument.
But you can't translate it to diabetes.
Exactly. That's just taken way too far. Yeah. You know, it's like, yes, people are going to be more likely to seek treatment if you understand their worldview of their disease and you talk to them within their cultural viewpoint. And these are the lifestyle changes you can make. These are the things. And yes, you might believe in qi, and maybe I can try and understand and translate this into a qi-like thing. But we still have to talk about it as if it's your body is an actual physical body with physical, you know, organs that do things.
Yeah, well, I mean, it's okay to take an intention to treat analysis where you basically say, if I prescribe this course of action, what happens? And that includes whether or not the patient will follow it. Yes. And if you're not, you know, including some kind of accommodation of their beliefs, which includes their culture, then you may come up with the best plan in the world on paper, but if they're not going to do it, it doesn't help anybody.
Yeah, so understanding...
You're dealing with people.
Yeah.
So you have to deal with people.
Like, how do you view your disease?
Yes.
Like, what's the way that you have contextualized this? And if you understand that it's easier as the treater, the healer, the physician, to work within that context so that they better understand you. But that doesn't mean you're going to not give them insulin.
Right, right. But this is different. This is saying... You're peeing too much because you have too much yin, and I have to give you this flour to reduce your
yang juice.
And that's how I understand your illness. And it's like, but that's all nonsense, you know? And the Chinese government is promoting traditional Chinese medicine because of cha-ching, because
of
medical tourism, because of just they're promoting their culture, their hegemony.
Of course.
And this took a few years for the World Health Organization to write these standards. And what was happening during that time was Korea and Japan and China were fighting over precedence. They were fighting over whose tradition gets mentioned more times in the, like there was no evidence to go over. Yeah. It was all just.
I accidentally called Reiki Chinese.
Yeah, it was all like cultural priority, right? That's what they're arguing. That's what we're reduced to, like arguing over which side of your bread you butter. You know?
Who do I get pissed at? Give me some names.
The World Health Organization, primarily.
But Steve, who pulled the lever on this? Somebody has to
It was the head of the WHO for the last 10 years who was Chinese, and he was promoting their own culture.
Oh my God.
And then everyone who lays down because it's like, oh, well, we can't offend another culture, so we have to sort of accept it. It's like, no,
But you can, both things can be true.
I know.
You know, you can be empathic and you can, like.
Be science-based.
Yes. Like, you can be a cultural contextualist. Like, we talk about this a lot. I'm not a cultural relativist. I don't think that if your culture says female circumcision is the way to go, that's just okay.
Yeah, right.
But I do think that context matters and we have to look at the world through the viewpoints of these people and understand why it is that these things aren't being taken in and square that circle. Yeah. But the thing that we hardly even mentioned here is that it's not just an outcome for the patient that, you know, their diabetes won't be treated and they could potentially die. Also, in the name of traditional Chinese medicine, the megafauna on this planet is being slaughtered in numbers that are just inconceivable. I mean, we have a massive crisis with rhinoceros, with elephant, with tiger, with we did that story about mule oil or whatever it was called. Remember donkey hide, that ass oil? And then also, and then
deer
also,
antler blood,
oh my God, pangolin. Pangolin is like the most trafficked animal on the planet. all for TCM.
Yeah, right.
Crazy. The only thing they don't harvest are people.
Horrible.
Yeah, we know.
Just horrible.
Their first thing that they'll use, they'll call it Soylent Green.
Yeah. Soylent Green.
So Steve, what are some of the major downsides to this? What could we expect to see downstream because of this specific incorporation?
It's obvious. I mean,
so it's going to be a way of sort of promoting.
What's not obvious?
Well, I mean, the thing is, the World Health Organization exists to bring quality healthcare to everyone in the world, right? And, you know, their main mission is to help, poor countries, developing countries, underserved people, to try to provide for them reasonable healthcare and to set standards for this is the standard of healthcare worldwide. So now this is now part of the standard, right?
Yeah. So here's an extreme example. We bring in herbs for Ebola.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. You know, like, can you imagine?
There were homeopaths trying to treat it with homeopathy, and they would love to have that be a part of the standard too.
Of course.
So right. it's the deeper issue that their standards are now based upon coddling traditions rather than on what works, what will actually bring better healthcare to people. And in this case, they're being pressured by actually a powerful country who was overtly trying to promote not only their own power economically in the world, but use this to rip people off, to rip off, for medical tourism. It's huge in Australia. This is like a huge controversy in Australia. You know, traditional Chinese medicine is big business and is being promoted and tolerated. And they're like, oh, this is all just cultural sensitivity. No, you're just ripping people off. Mm-hmm. And you want a license to rip more people off. And you don't care how many
That's
people
right.
die because
they use
it of
under
it.
The cloak.
Yeah, under the cloak of traditional sensitivity or whatever, but it's nonsense.
All right, how much outrage has arisen because of this?
Almost
you?
None. Yeah, right. It's like people who read science-based medicine, that's about
yeah,
it.
Yeah, right.
Yeah,
not nearly enough.
We're doing it, Bob. We've got it. We're trying to.
And again, like the Nature article, while it tried to like say, well, some people think this and whatever, there was a complete absence of outrage or like this is a bad thing or anything in the
Pathetic.
Article.
Let's talk about
terrible.
Something else.
Yes, Evan. Well. I'll take swords for 400. Evan, go ahead.
So
you're looking at the Queen of Sweden.
She is now. She is now. You know why?
Because this young 8-year-old girl pulled that sword out of a lake in Sweden.
Yes, and now she's queen.
And now she's queen.
Yeah. They knighted her with it.
Her name is Saga Vanacek, and she found the sword this past summer while playing in a lake on her family's property. Now, Sweden went through a bit of a drought this year, so the lake levels were a little bit lower than in prior years and prior times. So you have to go out a little bit further into the lake to get to the depths, in which you can play in the water. So she's playing in the water, and she's like, she comes across what she thinks is a stick, just a stick coming out of the water. She goes to, just grab it. She was going to, do whatever with it. And yes, pull up Excalibur. She is the lady of the lake now. And, she's
her
become...
Her arm was clad in the finest of chamois.
So this is a very old sword.
Yes.
What they originally reported on it being a 1,000-year-old sword, they are now saying it is more like a 1,500-year-old sword.
Nice.
Does she get to keep it?
No, it's been turned over. It's been turned over to the archaeological
team. Is it Viking?
It is pre-Viking.
Pre-Viking.
It's pre-Viking, which is really interesting.
Yeah.
This did take place well into the Iron Age. I mean, the Iron Age hit Europe sort of last. It started as the Mediterranean.
Yeah.
It hit there first, and then into Europe, and then Northern Europe, finally, they caught on. But you're still many, many hundreds of years into the Iron Age, but definitely before steel. It was also sheathed in a leather and wood wrapping, they said, which essentially is the sheath of the sword.
It didn't rot away?
No, it did not. It did not rot away. It's still under there.
Amazing.
Well, yeah, that's a good
the
question,
treated,
and that's what they're...
Or well, was the environment that it was in was like
low oxygen.
Yeah.
What's in the lake, but also perhaps what kind of iron exactly is this? Now, in Denmark, there is an iron that exists naturally called bog iron, B-O-G, bog iron, in which it has some properties which resists rusting over time. Mm-hmm. It lasts longer. And so perhaps they think maybe it is a bog iron and allowed it to survive as long as it did.
You know what's another kind of iron that could survive a long time?
No. Tell me.
Meteorite.
Oh, yeah.
Because it has a lot of nickel in it. So you get like an iron-nickel alloy, which can be stainless.
Yeah, the biggest thing you have to be careful of if you collect those like metallic meteorites is making sure they don't rust.
Yeah.
Because they will rust. Yeah, mm-hmm. You have to be careful about that. But they do last. They last a really long time.
But they have a lot of nickel, though. They could be stainless.
Ev, I think that when the scientists went there, they found more artifacts, too, right?
They did find more artifacts. Yep, they found a brooch from roughly what they are dating around the same time.
Ooh, was it pretty?
Haven't quite seen it yet. I looked for a picture of it, but I did not see it. I imagine it's encrusted.
So who were these people who left these artifacts?
Yes, who were these people? That is part of the mystery. They're trying to come up with some sort of story, right? Right. And who would throw, how did a sheathed sword get into the water sort of in the first place?
Was it a lake or was it part of, connected to the ocean?
No, it's a lake.
And was it a lake 1,500 years ago?
Was it a lake 1,500 years ago? Right. What was it?
Yeah, I wonder if there's even more.
There's been no archaeological activity in this area up till now. Now that this discovery has happened, the archaeologists have moved in. It could be. They're looking for evidence of burials and other things going on in the area. They did find a bone roughly from the area. I can't remember which kind of bone, but it was a human bone. So now they're doing a much more thorough investigation.
I wanted to hear more about this. They might find some cache of stuff, you know?
Yeah. And the family is hoping that when it winds up in the museum on display for everyone, it'll be known as Sarah's sword.
Yeah. Yeah.
Oh, great. And that photo right there will be next to it in the museum display.
So that is awesome. Really that is so fun.
They think about a year or so it will take for the full analysis of the sword.
And we don't even know what it's made of yet.
No, they've not determined it. It's not been reported.
Yeah, just because it was, we were talking about this before, just because it was in the Iron Age doesn't mean that everything was made of iron.
Right. You know? That's right.
That means that's when people had the ability to, you know, refine iron ore and to make stuff out of iron. But that, you know.
But a lot of these regions in the Northern Europe were cut off in the few hundred years before these times we're talking about because of the wars. And there were so many conflicts going on. It cut the trade. Basically. Yeah. So for a long time, you didn't have these materials coming up to the Scandinavian countries. They had to do with whatever they had naturally occurring. Mm-hmm. So we'll have to wait. You know, it's a mystery.
Definitely a story we should follow to see like what
we will.
What
a year
develops.
From now, let's see what they tell us.
Now,
cool.
Yeah, but they didn't say the whole second half to this news item that no one knows about.
Okay.
This is that little girl, Sarah.
Mm-hmm.
This is her superhero origin. Because that's a sword of power.
Yes. Yeah. Of course.
Oh, yeah.
Like with the equivalent of what He-Man's sword was, and this is now her.
Yeah, and when she's a teenager, she'll have a calling.
Okay.
She'll be drawn to the museum where the sword is.
Oh,
she will reach through the glass into the case, pull it out, and she will become Astra or something. She'll become a superhero. It's going to happen. You're going to see.
Mm-hmm. I smell a Highlander episode here somewhere or something.
Highlander.
There can be only one.
So, Kara. Tell us about the HPV vaccine. I know this has been such an accurately and expertly reported news item.
Oh my gosh, I know. Like just digging into this news item has really confused me. I don't know why I take my glasses off when I actually need to look at things.
I do that all the time.
I think it's because I'm nearsighted and not farsighted. Anyway, cervical cancer, HPV vaccines, new study in The Lancet. All very confusing. The main crux of some of the coverage that you're seeing, one big article from the Sydney Morning Herald, a big article in the New York Times, comes out of this Lancet, what did they call it? Lancet Public Health article. And it's all about modeling what's going to happen within the Australian public following some big public health changes that were made. And there's two big changes. Number one, mandatory HPV vaccine for youth. I want to say they started with girls around age 12 or 13. And then a few years later, they opened it up to young boys as well. So any boy or girl that went to school at kind of what they consider to be like a pre-sexual age was able to get this vaccine to prevent the spread of HPV. But also that was coupled with an increase in cervical cancer screening. So they had kind of a massive public health campaign to get women to go see the gynecologist and at the time get Paps. Now that has since moved on to a pure HPV test and it's moved down from getting annual Paps to getting like, I think once every 5 years is the new, the new, what do you call it, standard
progress,
of care.
Scientific progress.
Yeah, and so these researchers were like, well, let's model this based on a lot of different variables. So based on the rate of vaccination, based on the rate of cervical cancer diagnosis, based on access to these medical services. And we're going to model what it looks like, you know, this many years from now, that many years from now. How are we going to get these numbers down? So currently in Australia, 7 cases, and maybe we should actually make a clarification now. HPV is human papillomavirus, mm-hmm. and there's a bunch of different kinds, different mm-hmm. strains.
Yep. Yeah.
There are high-risk strains that are responsible for downstream a fair amount of cervical cancer cases, but there are other kinds that the vaccine doesn't prevent against. And also, cervical cancer is not the only downstream effect of HPV. HPV can cause genital warts. Mm-hmm. HPV can cause other types of cancers, you know, genital cancers, anal cancers, throat cancer. You'll see this a lot. So, but cervical cancer, when we finally linked those two things and realized, wow, high rate of HPV infection leads to a high rate of cervical cancer, we're like, we could do something. It's like a preventable cancer.
Yeah.
It's a big deal. Yeah, vaccine for cancer is amazing. Yeah. And so vaccine was developed. The rate right now in Australia is 7 out of every 100,000 cases. Cervical cancer, not HPV.
Seven
cases of cervical cancer.
Out of 100,000
100,000 people.
Right. All right, that's
that seems really low, right?
Yeah.
So,
but it's a high for a cancer.
Yeah. And it's all, I mean, it's a deadly disease, you know? Worldwide, I think it's closer to half a billion, 500,000. Half a million cases worldwide. Mm-hmm. But so they have these thresholds. And I'm not sure if these are universal or I should say international standards, mm-hmm. like global public health standards, or if they're Australian standards, but they're calling 6 cases out of 100,000 to be a rare cancer threshold. So once they can get that number down to 6 out of 100,000, they can call it a rare cancer. Once they get it down to 4 out of 100,000, it's a lower threshold. And they're calling it essentially eradicated if it's 1 out of 100,000. Mm. So they basically took all this big data and they modeled how long is it going to take.
Yeah, that's great.
And their estimates. And also you've got to remember, too, that they estimated based on if screening continues as planned or if screening gets backed off, because they're saying the vaccine alone might not be enough. Mm-hmm. It's definitely not all we need, because there's a whole population of people who never got vaccinated.
Is it mandatory now?
It is there for school children, but of course, if like we wouldn't have gotten the vaccine, right? Because we were older when the vaccine came out.
I don't need it though.
And that's linked to, you don't need it because you're not.
But I don't want to get ass cancer.
Bound to go out. Well, that's what I'm saying, man. Yeah. Ass cancer. Yeah, you don't have a cervix, but you could get ass cancer. Throat cancer.
Totally.
There actually is an increase in throat cancer linked to HPV. That's one of the things they cited in here. But anyway, so their new estimate, if current practices continue, their report is saying by 2028, mm-hmm. they think that the number would be fewer than 4 women.
Mm-hmm. Great.
And by 2066, their estimate is basically
eradicated.
Yeah, it could be eradicated.
At this pace.
Yeah, but here's the concern. Not all cervical cancer is caused by HPV. Okay. And this vaccine does not protect against all HPVs.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So there's still, it protects against,
the worst ones.
Yeah, the worst ones that count for, I think, 90% of cervical cancer cases. But how is that eradication?
But they're counting 1 out of 100,000
as eradication.
And so this is 90% would take it from 7 to 1.
Exactly.
Right?
Yeah.
Polio could be literally eradicated.
Exactly.
Polio has
there's no non-human reservoir.
Yeah.
But here's the interesting thing. This is being hailed, and I think it should be hailed, as a real triumph in Australia, mm-hmm. which it is. Mm-hmm. I mean, this is a really big deal. They moved quickly. Everybody got behind it. But their rate is 7 out of 100,000. What do you think the American rate is? 7.4 out of 100,000.
Yeah. Oh, wow.
And in America, only something like 50% of these school-age children are getting the vaccine. So maybe it's the case that number's going to rise. I don't know. You know, and a lot of experts are trying
to decrease as much as it are.
Exactly.
So if they get it down that low, since it's a virus, it gets passed from person to person.
Mm-hmm.
But this could be gotten rid of.
The virus, sure. But all of the conversation is actually about cervical cancer. It's the rates of the cancer that develops after the infection by the virus. They're not talking about eradicating the virus.
Yeah.
And so I think it's But the weird thing is, when I actually go back to the source article, it's not shoddy reporting. That's what the source article is saying.
Yeah, they're confusing.
They're conflating
those the virus and the cancer itself.
Yeah. And so, and maybe it's because for it's all 90%, intents and purposes, they can say that. But there are probably always going to be cervical cancer cases that come from a different origin. So we do have to remember that.
Okay.
But I mean, that doesn't undo. I mean,
it's kind of like if we got rid of smoking, we would. Mostly get rid of lung cancer.
Yeah, some people would still spontaneously.
But there
were
still
going
to be rare cases of non-smoking.
Yeah, so yeah, okay, that makes sense.
But I think it's cool because it points to A, the fact that vaccines work, and these orchestrated, mandatory, you know, campaigns, they work.
Yeah.
It also points to the fact that we have to vaccinate the boys. That's so important because they're the carriers. And just because oftentimes boys don't have symptoms because they don't have a cervix.
Right.
Because a lot of girls will get HPV and they'll only know it because they get an HPV test at the gynecologist. Yeah. They won't have any symptoms. Boys might have certain strains that cause genital warts. That's what genital warts are. They're they're pathognomonic.
Yeah. Is that right? Are they?
I think so. Okay. Of HPV.
That's what the papilloma is, right?
That's the papilloma.
Yeah, it's the wart. Yeah.
But most people are asymptomatic. They just don't know they're carrying it.
Yeah.
And then they're the vector, really.
So we clearly need to develop a pap trap.
Pap trap. So that's what we've been doing.
Yeah, so they have to get vaccinated.
A pap.
And so the same way that, you know, here in America, we require that school children get certain vaccines in order to be in school together.
Yeah.
Universities require meningitis vaccines.
Yeah.
MMR is usually required. Is tetanus required?
No.
Not
yes.
Well.
No,
I
it is.
First
it is.
One is.
I think it is.
I think boosters aren't required.
I'm fully behind getting rid of ass cancer as well.
Exactly. Like, if this became part of our mandatory schedule, we might see some real improvements.
Yeah.
And the real struggle with this is where do you think the highest rates of HPV are? In the poorest countries.
Oh, yeah, of course.
Yeah. Places where, because Gardasil is actually quite expensive. And a big part of the Australian campaign was it was offered free to school children.
Right. You can't beat that.
Deal.
How many times do you have to get the new vaccines every 10 years or something like that?
With this one, I think I'm not sure actually if you need boosters. I haven't read anything about boosters. But it is a course of two vaccines if you're young. Cool addendum to this story. The FDA just approved the HPV vaccine Gardasil for people aged 27 to 45. Because up until now, it was only approved for young people.
Yeah.
I missed the window. I never got my HPV
vaccine.
Yeah,
but now you're in the window again.
But now I could get it again. Yeah.
So,
but apparently for adults, you have to get three.
Yeah.
And it kind of hurts.
Yeah, so our response is less.
Yeah.
But it's probably cost effective to give it out for free. Like, what does it cost the healthcare system to treat all the cancer versus just give out the vaccine? It probably saves you money.
And it also probably.
So that's super cool. I think it's a win for vaccination. It's, again, more evidence to show that vaccine has these public health outcomes. Mm. But also, we're doing pretty well in America.
Yeah.
Like, let's not underscore.
No, we actually have good, you know, on this the spectrum thing, we have pretty good vaccine laws. You know, better than the UK, actually.
Mm.
For most people, there was mandatory vaccines to go to school.
Yeah, the problem is some places are trying to reel them back.
I know,
in Poland,
we found that
they're trying to abolish compulsory vaccinations for children. And that's going to, if that passes through, and it actually passed through, the Ministry of Health, the Parliament's lower house, I apologize, voted 252 to 158 with two abstentions Thursday to send the issue to parliamentary groups for further discussion. So it seems like there's people who want this.
It doesn't make any sense to me. It boggles my mind.
It's very strange. I mean, gosh. And think about it. No polio, no measles,
right.
No whooping cough.
Don't people realize what they have right now? And they don't. They must not.
Well, everyone, we're going to take a quick break from our show to talk about one of our sponsors this week, LinkedIn.
If you own your own business, it's hugely important that you actually hire the right people for the position. It can make or break your company. The problem is, where are you going to find these eligible candidates that have the skill sets that you require? Instead of posting on job boards, you can find the person who's going to help your business grow by using LinkedIn.
LinkedIn is the world's largest professional network. People go to LinkedIn every day to grow professionally and discover job opportunities. In fact, 70% of the United States workforce is already there. LinkedIn Jobs matches people to your role based on who they really are, their skills, interests, and even how open they are to new opportunities. Businesses rate LinkedIn 40% higher than job boards at delivering quality candidates.
So go to linkedin.com/skeptics and get $50 off your first job post. That's linkedin.com/skeptics to get $50 off your first job post.
All right, guys, let's get back to the show.
I was thinking, what artifact from science, present or past, mm-hmm. would you like to own?
And okay, so we have to set some parameters.
Parameters?
Just meaning that, so it doesn't have to be practical that you can get it. Like, I could say something that would be impossible to get. I want the thing.
Yeah.
So we're setting aside how are you going to obtain it.
But it has to be tangible.
Yeah, it has to be a
physical thing.
Okay. Yeah, I'm thinking, so this will give you a good example. I'm thinking it'd be cool to own Sputnik, the first man-made object in outer space. It's retro-looking, it's cool-looking, it made a cool beeping noise. It was big enough, you know. It was. I'm pointing to a...
Yeah, sure did.
To see it. It was like a small basketball, right?
Yeah.
Oh, really? Okay. You know, how long were the thingies?
Pretty long. Pretty long. Like 8 feet, I think, if I remember correctly.
The antenna. So, they're called antenna. Yeah.
So when people have like Sputnik lamps in their house, they actually kind of just look like Sputnik.
Yeah.
Yes.
They're not like they're not like smaller models. They're just like Sputnik sized.
Yeah. So what do you got? What would you want from science?
The Library of Alexandria.
Oh, yeah.
You win.
It has to be.
You win.
Can we please change it to like something that could fit in your house?
Now you're being
arbitrarily right, fine. You get the Library of Alexandria. No explanation needed.
I win.
Yeah.
that would be awesome.
What do you got?
There's so many things. And again, that's why I wanted to know, like, if it's practicality is not an issue. Like, I would say I would like a complete specimen of a last common ancestor between humans and chimps.
Okay.
Right? You could ask for that sort of thing. Where,
that's amazing.
Yeah.
Like, you mean the thing right before...
Would consider the one specimen that is the best representation of the last common ancestor between humans and chimps, I want that full, complete skeleton.
That's awesome,
skeleton,
Steve. Right? Maybe we'll find it someday.
Yeah.
Bob, what do you got?
I would like a skull made out of the first atoms ever to come in existence after the Big Bang.
No. No, because you're conjuring up an item that doesn't exist. I want to hear you talk about something that exists.
So he wants those atoms in a jar.
First, I want the first atoms ever to coalesce after the Big Bang in the shape of a skull.
He wants a little dust. He just wants some dust. That's all he's asking for.
It's always you, Bob. It's always you.
So, Bob, there are...
All right, fine. Okay, you can have it. Fine.
So there are chondrites, which I know are not the first atoms, but, like, do you collect meteorites?
No.
Bob!
I would if I could, but I just don't see any.
They're so easy to collect. They're not that expensive. You can get small specimens.
Small ones.
And there are beautiful chondrites that are basically time capsules. I mean, they're some of the oldest things on our planet. And you can hold them in your hand. And you can see, like, the modeling from how they coalesced.
That'd be cool. But if I'm going, like, high in the sky, I have to come up with something better. Like,
it's an off-the-cuff question that deserves an off-the-cuff answer.
How about the first living organism on Earth? First thing that could be considered a living organism.
It would look like a little,
small.
It'd be microscopic.
Yeah. Yeah.
Like a little diatom or something.
All right, Evan, your turn.
I would say maybe Galileo's telescope.
Yeah,
that's cool. Pretty iconic in its own right.
That's cool.
To know that those are the first—that's the first metal and glass that actually captured what he saw and what he was able to record.
Where is Galileo's telescope? I'm sure he had more than one.
Whatever happened to it? Yeah.
Where do you think they're in a museum?
The one from his 1610 observations? Yeah. I don't know where it is.
So this isn't quite as cool. But when and if you come to LA to visit, I want to take you to Mount Wilson.
I want to go.
Yeah, I want to go.
To the 15-inch. Unless we have to spend a lot of money if we want to rent it for the night. But even just to visit, you can visit Hubble's Locker.
Oh, my God.
Which is really cool.
So awesome.
Yeah, but, you know, some things that popped into my mind were like, you know, like the magnifying glass that Darwin used. You know, or like one of his little insect cages that he had. You know, like cool, something cool like that to have in your house that you could talk to people about.
What's his name? Hook. His microscope, right? Like where he first discovered cells.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Like,
how about the first fossil ever created on the planet? The very first thing that fossilized.
Yeah. That would be awesome.
Yeah. A fossil of the very first multicellular.
But if you had it, see, this is the thing. The problem with your skull and fossil thing is if you had it, how could you prove that it was what it was?
But I would know. That's all that matters.
Yeah. Well, I'd know, too. That means I'd take it from you.
I just feel like, I just kind of feel like my thing is, like, a little more useful than you guys.
But I would also like to have a, you know, a cool dinosaur skeleton, you know?
So this is ethics aside.
Yeah, no ethics. Yeah,
no ethics.
Want,
right,
this is all greed. We just
I want all the
cool.
Golden Fortnite.
Yeah. And I guess my impromptu segment is over now.
But Kara does win with the Library of Alexandria.
Yeah, okay.
That'd be great.
I'll share.
Kara of Alexandria.
I know all the things. Please don't burn it down again.
But it's cool. But as cool as that would be, I would prefer that it would never have been destroyed in the first place.
Of course. Sure. I mean, think about how much more advanced we
probably
would be
wouldn't
now.
Be here, because that would suck.
Yeah, that would really have changed. Very butterfly effect situation.
We wouldn't be here.
But there's so many things like that. Like, I want all of the Bibles that were destroyed, you know, that were not canon, you know?
Because part of it is like, I want something that I couldn't ever have,
right?
Because it no longer exists, right? No longer. But it's also something that has
dense with knowledge.
Dense with knowledge. It has so much utility, and it's like, oh my gosh, just imagine what we would learn about what we knew already. Mm-hmm. And actually, there are probably certain things in there that are going to be new to us.
Yeah,
and that's pretty.
Well,
cool.
Yeah, just the literature, even the non-scientific literature, would be like, oh my god,
the world could have been a different place if that library didn't.
Well, who was it? Was it Sagan who said that we could be traveling to the nearest stars now, because we could have been centuries more advanced than we would be now.
Big reset button there.
Right. Yeah. Oh my god.
But you're right, we probably wouldn't be here. That's like a massive butterfly effect situation.
Yeah. Every atom that you're made of would exist, would just be like in different people, in the ground, in animals, not together.
There'd be no Evan.
You'd be a bird.
Well, not the Evan we know.
No, you wouldn't exist.
There would never, ever be.
In no sense would you exist. Okay.
I'm quite glad Alexandria Burton.
Everything had to happen the way it did in order, before you were born. Think about it. The probability of the sperm that, resulted in you hitting the egg is so small. If one of your parents sneezed, and that would have been somebody else. Somebody else would be here in your place.
Sure.
Probably not here, but I mean here on the earth.
Yeah,
holding his cell phone in that front pocket just a little longer.
That's why all of those time travel movies where like the time changes and it's the same people in different situations. Like, no, every single person would be a different person.
Yeah.
There's no way the same two eggs and sperms would get together under even slightly altered circumstances.
Of course.
So science or fiction. You guys ready for it?
It's time for science or fiction.
Each week I come up with three science news items, four facts, two real, and one fictitious. And then I challenge my panelist skeptics to tell me which one is the fake. And we have a theme. What do you think the theme is?
Theme is Comic-Con.
Theme is inspired by one of the news items tonight.
Monkey, sword.
No. Annabelle.
Metallurgy.
Swords. Metallurgy.
Oh. I'll take S words for a
I'll
thousand.
I'll take swords for a thousand.
I'm not going to do well at this.
Come on, here we go.
Probably not.
Metallurgy.
All right, here we go. Three items having to do with metallurgy.
Okay.
You ready?
Mm-hmm.
One is, item number one, making aluminum or aluminium.
Yep.
Yes.
It's in the book.
From recycled scrap uses 92% less energy than making it from ore. Mm. Item number two. There is evidence for welding with solder 3,000 years ago. And item number three, iron, cobalt, and nickel are the only ferromagnetic elements.
That sucks. That last one really pisses me off.
Yeah,
that
does.
That's
science.
Yeah,
that's
I know.
Crazy.
I should know that. How do I not know that?
Evan, why don't we start with you?
So making aluminium from recycled scrap uses 92% less energy than making it from ore. Sure. Why not? Because the hard part's done, right? Is that the idea behind this one? There's so much how do you get it from the ore? That's the whole key here to this one. 92%. I have a feeling that one's right. The second one is there's evidence for welding with solder 3,000 years ago. What'd they find? A 3,000-year-old soldering iron? What did they? 3,000 years ago. Crap. Rums. I got to put all the metals in my head and in the calendar and in the age.
Head,
this is hard. I don't know about that one. That one could be fiction.
Mm-hmm.
Iron, cobalt, and nickel are the only ferromagnetic elements. Well, all right. Two is so out. The soldering one's kind of outlandish. I have a feeling that one's going to wind up being the science, because that one's like the surprise of the three. And therefore, it comes down to my lack of knowledge about the magnetic properties of these elements. Gosh, fine. Iron, cobalt, and nickel. I'll say there's another ferromagnetic element in there that's missing.
Okay, Bob.
Ooh, I mean, I'm going to go with the asymmetry that I noticed. The recycled aluminum seems too obvious. Like, of course. The other one's like,
wait, what? So I'm gonna go with aluminum. 92% less energy kind of makes sense, but that's really high. I think it's probably less than that, by somewhat not insignificant amount. Maybe it's 60%, but I don't think it's quite that high. And I just think that's the kind of angle you took with this. I'll say that one is fiction.
Kara?
Jay and I were testing whether this nickel was magnetic.
Whoa.
But then I realized there's probably no nickel in the nickel anymore.
Did you just figured that
just
one
junk.
Out.
Dang it.
What is this?
That's one.
I was actually leaning towards the first one, not because it seemed obvious. To me, it seemed like, so making aluminum from recycled scrap. I didn't say from pure aluminum. So how is that any different than making it from ore? If anything, it's probably harder because it's actually been machined to be somehow combined with other metals. And now we have to, again, pull out all the aluminum and,
if you knew how aluminum was originally made from the ore, then you'd be able to easily figure that one out.
It's not about figuring it out. It's about using energy. And yes, one of them is mining it out of the ground. And now we're taking it out of these large landfills or these large recycling centers. And I think recycling centers actually use a mess of energy to the extent that, like, you can't even recycle plastic anymore in Oregon because they're like, it's not worth it. You don't get enough uses out of it, and it's, like, really hard on the environment. So that one was sticking out to me as the science. Evidence for welding with solder 3,000 years ago. I mean, I'm thinking 150. How old was the sword?
1,500
years. Oh.
That would be more than.
That's twice as many. Okay, but so that sword was likely not just like smelted and then just cast in all one piece, right? It was probably different metals, or maybe they were somehow, because there's metal working a long time ago, but what kind of metallurgy were they doing? I mean, really, solder, it involves using a softer or easier to work with metal to basically glue other metal pieces together. So getting it just hot enough that these other things will stick. And I feel like that's probably the first way that they figured out how to join two metals. They probably figured out how to solder long before they figured out how to, like, get both metals high enough to glue together. Because now you can weld without solder, but you need really good tools. I don't know if back then, they didn't have welding irons. They just used, like, hot pokers. Iron, cobalt, and nickel are the only ferromagnet. That one's so mean.
Yeah, it makes me mad that I don't know the answer to that off the top of my head.
None of us know this. I don't know. I didn't even know cobalt was magnetic, did you? I thought cobalt was, like,
blue.
I don't think it was metal. Oh, my gosh. Okay, so that's really mean. Aluminum's not magnetic. That I know. What are other metal? Gold, silver, they're not magnetic. Platinum's not magnetic.
Remember, not just magnetic.
Ferromagnetic.
Yeah, you're right. Yeah, I'm going to say, I don't know. I think I'm going to go with Bob on this one, but not because it seemed obviously right wrong. But to me, it actually is the first one that stuck out to me. Go with my gut. GWB.
All right, so this first one about the aluminum, you know, if you think of it, all right, now first he says, making aluminum from recycled scrap. So it's from the moment the scrap is dumped off at the furnace. I do know that if you take an aluminum can, I mean, I know there's stuff that they coat the inside with, and there's inks on the outside, but all that shit just, you know, when you put it in 3,000 degrees or wherever hot the furnaces are, it just turns into vapor. It's gone. So I could see that it could be super less energy to recycle. This 92% seems very high, though. But so I think there's some truth in that no matter what. There's definitely, it's more efficient to recycle, I'm sure. Moving on to the second one. What the hell? Like, first of all, from my understanding of solder, it doesn't have any integrity. It's not a strong metal, right? So it can't weld, you can't weld metals together 3,000 years ago with solder and have it do anything good. I mean, it's great for electrical connections. But if it's like the solder that I'm used to using, it's super, first off, it melts and dries it very quickly. You know what I mean? Like, meaning it's like, it's a great thing to work with because you can heat it up real quick and it'll turn to liquid, you know, like mercury. It looks like mercury. And then you can just blow on it and it gets hard again, you know? But I still.
Don't even go there.
But what were they soldering?
Maybe, like, electrical circuits.
3,000 years ago? What? There's nothing to solder 3,000 years ago. And then you also do, like she was saying, you do need a way to melt it. Like, the way that we use it today and the way that they use it back then, you know, but you're saying welding, and I could see, you know, they're not doing, like, you know, steam's coming out. So, okay, but I just don't.
With the sponge.
I'm not liking that one. Yeah.
Yeah, the little sponge.
The ferromagnetic elements, I admit to science. I'm sorry, science. I don't know this science. I should know the answer to this question.
And even worse, I did know it, but now I just
I forgot the details.
Yeah, definitely. I used to know that one. I'm really not liking the welding one, so I'm picking that one.
Okay. So good, you're all spread out.
That's right.
No, nobody picked three, did they?
I did.
Yeah,
oh,
Evan did.
No way. Okay, but
Steve can't win.
Real
Steve,
quick.
No, I won when you spread out all three.
There are types of welding. Yeah, that solder is only one type of solder.
I'm sure there's different kinds. But like, wait,
when you weld with a big
this.
Welding thing, you can also weld
I mean,
with solder.
Is the process of melting say gold metal. And then it reforming, is that considered solder?
If it's right. used to glue two
it might be right.
Solder is a metal that's used to glue two other metals
more
together.
Importantly
it can be any metal.
It's likely that one of us got it right.
It is true,
right?
One of us got it right. Yeah.
I vote and it's majority rules. Who's with me? I vote that whoever wins gets to slap Steve.
Define slap.
But what if Bob like, and okay. I win?
That's fine. Well, my vote counts for five. I guess we'll take them in order since you're spread all of that.
I want to be surprised.
He's taking them in order.
Okay. Making aluminum from recycled scrap uses 92% less energy than making it from ore. Bob and Kara think this one is fiction, and this one is science.
That's good. I mean, I'm glad that that is
so what
the
else,
answer
Steve?
There.
So recycling aluminum is a good idea.
Yeah, it absolutely. Is. It's one of the few things that are so, glass really glass worth too, right? recycling.
Like you're correct, Kara, in that not everything is good to recycle, you know, energy-wise, but the metals, yes.
Yes, okay. Oh, absolutely.
Yeah, yeah. If you remember, the thing that you may know that would have tipped you off is that aluminum's really hard to mine, to make from ore.
Gotcha.
Remember, in the 19th century, you did know that, because we talked about the fact that in the 19th century, aluminum was more expensive than gold.
Yep, because it was super hard. It was super hard to extract.
Super hard to extract.
Gotcha.
And then when they figured out how to cheaply extract it from ore, That was Alcoa. That was the American aluminum organization.
Alcoa.
Yeah, that then it became the cheapest like industrial metal. Went from the most expensive to the cheapest overnight. So if you had like aluminum futures, you were screwed.
Yeah.
because it's the
put third, all my money.
It's the most common metal in the world on the earth. It's the third most common element on the earth,
wow.
And so it's just like everywhere in the soil. But we couldn't. It was just really expensive to get it into, you know, into a metal.
And the good thing is it's light and it's strong.
Well, yeah,
it's
yeah.
like amazing, durable.
All recyclable. Things being yeah. equal, it's almost always better to reuse something
yeah.
that you've already used but than to get more of it out of the ground.
Metals are really good at being reused, though.
Yeah. Yeah, so here's some statistics. So the figures I saw for aluminum were 92 to 95%. I went with the lower one, but some gate references gave 95%.
Wow.
90% for copper. 56% for steel. But that's less. That's 56% less energy intense than mining it out of the ground.
But how many people do you think choose, or I don't even know if it is a choice, to build with recycled steel over virgin steel?
Yeah, how do you ever go and like, I've bought steel components.
Yeah. But I mean, the people who build buildings, they make a choice about the quality of them.
I'm sure that, we get into like metal fatigue and what happens to it. And like, if you re-smelt it, if you re-smelt it,
then you have to re-delt it.
Then you re-delt it.
Nice.
I don't know what happens to the metal. Like, how many times can you liquefy it
but
and
I
bring
think
it back?
I do think it's highly recyclable. Yeah,
yeah.
That's
infinite.
What I was thinking.
Why would there be a limitation?
I don't
know, because when
like the reset button,
too.
Right?
Yeah, I think it does.
I think you can melt down glass over and over. It's just a function of the clarity.
So. Sure, I would think.
Yeah. Plastic you can't.
Which is why, plastic is horrible. It's like, if you only get a few uses out of most types of plastic.
Yeah, there's really no point to recycling certain things, like paper. Things actually, we grow trees for the pulp. It's fine.
It doesn't really affect landfills, from my understanding. Like paper,
it rots
pretty quickly.
But your cans and stuff, absolutely.
Yeah.
All right, let's go on number two.
Here we go.
There is evidence for welding with solder 3,000 years ago. Jay, you think this one is a fiction? Everyone else thinks this one is science.
Evan Smacky.
You're still alive. You think the other one is the fiction?
Correct.
The magnetic
element.
Right.
One
so
of
is
us
it
gets to smack
Jay or is it Evan?
I'm so glad it wasn't me, actually.
The welding from 3,000 years ago is science.
Oh, wow. What did they weld? Steve, what did they weld?
Nice, sir.
Evan. They welded stuff.
Like what?
So, this and that.
I didn't really read the article.
This and that.
Kara was incorrect in that this is. Welding with solder is not the oldest form of welding.
Oh, it's not.
The oldest form of welding is what's called pressure welding, where you basically just bang stuff together.
That's it's not even welding.
I know. That's why I didn't count that.
Yeah.
Because okay.
You just smash it together until it kind of stays.
Yeah, but there was a little bit of a technique. Like they would have rocks that would sort of make divots, and the divots were kind of holding it together.
Yeah.
And it's called pressure welding. But you're right. It's sort of pseudo welding. So I didn't want to count
that. What about that thing where they stack rocks in the way that they want them, and then they put logs in? You know, then they melt. They light the logs on fire, and it would melt the rock.
Well, that's just making the metal out of the ore, right?
No. I'm saying that they fuse rocks together by...
Oh, that's sintering.
Sintering.
That's sintering is when you make something sticky, but you don't fully melt it.
Right.
Like platinum was sintered for a long time because platinum is a really high melting point, and it took technology to really melt it to really... But anyway, though, this was actual soldering. And what they would do is they would take a softer metal, like lead or something, and they would melt it, and they would actually blow it through a tube into the crevices of joints between two metal plates or something in a chest or something.
Oh, wow.
And that would solder the two things together. Cool. They used it as a glue, and it was real soldering. But they didn't have the thing, you know.
Yeah,
but it's
still called soldering.
It was still soldering.
It's just a softer metal joining two other metals.
It was still welding, and it was welding with solder, just not with the modern.
I'm fine.
Have you ever welded?
Yeah, I love welding.
Some of them it's just fire or heat or whatever you want to call it, but some of them have solder in them.
I've done it all.
Now, the modern form of arc welding. Arc welding.
Yes.
Now, arc welding is you don't use solder, right? But that's because you can make a hot enough, you know, and focused enough, you know, heat in order to melt the steel itself. Mm-hmm. That was a huge advance, When we had the technology to arc weld, then we could make pipes that could carry gasoline and gas, you know, like natural gas, you know, into homes and stuff like that. That like was a huge innovation, the arc welding. Okay.
I love all that welding. I love welding. I wanted to weld stainless steel furniture.
My ignorance of chemistry won the day today.
Not only did Evan win, but he went first and none.
That's true.
That's right.
All right, but let's do it formally. Right. Iron, cobalt, and nickel are the only ferromagnetic elements. This one is fiction, and Evan is correct. This was a really tricky one, too.
Yeah.
But I didn't actually capture any of you in the way that I would have been caught by this one if I weren't paying attention. Iron, cobalt, and nickel are the only ferromagnetic metals at room temperature. If you have to go by their Curie point,
elements.
I said elements.
Which is way broader.
There's two other ferromagnetic elements. And you could have known this, because what's the medical one that you all have heard of?
Titanium?
No, that's not ferromagnetic.
Well, mercury?
No.
Medical element?
Yeah, so what element reacts to a magnetic field and it's used in medical imaging?
Oh, for the contrast agent. Yeah, I don't know what's in it.
Gadolinium.
Gadolinium. Okay. Yes.
I remember.
Yeah, so
gadolinium has to be ferromagnetic, but not in its metallic form.
Agent metal.
Yeah.
Agent metal.
That's correct. And there's another one which I forget. Dysprosium. So the Curie temperature is the temperature at which, like, if you heat iron to 1400 and 18 degrees Fahrenheit or 770 degrees Celsius, it loses its ferromagnetic property.
Oh, interesting.
Cobalt is 1130 degrees Celsius. Nickel, 358 degrees Celsius. Gadolinium is 19 degrees Celsius below room temperature.
Whoa.
And dysprosium is minus 185 degrees.
Okay.
So not in their metallic form. They're not magnetic, but those are the only, you know, like actual things that you would think of as metals, you know.
I like watching welding and iron craft. You know, like blacksmithing in YouTube videos. And it's cool. I didn't know that fact that you just said about iron losing its magnetic field. So I just saw a video of a guy doing it, and he said it. I'm like, oh, my God, I never heard of that. I've never heard that before. That's crazy. But it for some reason, it does do that.
Yeah.
I got to read more about magnetism. I want to understand, like, the
physics. It has to do with the magnetic fields of the electrons and how they line up.
Maybe for the people out there who don't know what ferromagnetic means, we should probably define it. Not for any of us.
Yeah.
But for the people that are listening.
A ferromagnet is
what you would think of.
You can put a magnet, you could make it permanently magnetic, right? You can hold the magnetic field. But say something that's diamagnetic can react passively to a magnetic field, but can't hold a magnetic field.
So I have a question for you. Where does the energy come from to make a magnet magnetic?
The electron.
And eventually it'll lose its magnetic properties?
So yeah, it does. If you had a bar magnet, it wouldn't stay magnetic forever. Eventually they'll randomize the orient. So how do you make like an iron bar into an iron magnet? you expose it to a magnetic field, then you right. whack it, right? That's the easiest way to do it.
We used to do that in
right. So you as an so experiment they so in school. You jiggle up all the all the atoms, right? And then they align themselves to the magnetic field. So now they're all a little bit in alignment, and so their magnetic fields line up. So now they have a magnetic field. So, but they will tend to revert to a randomized state.
Okay, so even in that solid state, they will move a little bit,
just really slowly.
Or you put a wire around it.
Well then you're using the energy of the current to create a magnetic field.
That's correct. Yeah.
The magnetic field comes from the circuit,
right?
Because comes from the moving electrons.
As was explained to me by my ex-boyfriend, who is a NASA scientist, magnets and electricity are just two sides of the same coin. And right. I was like, I'm still very lost. Yeah. But thank you.
And according to Insane Clown Posse, magnets are miracles.
So the way to think about it is a moving magnetic field will generate an electric current, and a moving electrical current will generate a magnetic field.
Right.
That's amazing. They're really connected.
Right. And electromagnetic waves are when they're basically doing it to each other and perpetuating as a wave.
So that was
Maxwell, right?
That's when there's a relationship.
But I'm still confused about the difference. Like, I get that produces a ferromagnet, but I still don't really understand what a diamagnet, a non-ferromagnetic field.
In other words, like, they'll orient themselves, they're free-flowing, that will orient themselves to a magnetic field. And then as soon as the magnetic field goes away, they randomize.
Gotcha.
It doesn't hold.
But think about that. Cool. You know, you would think that early scientists knew of electricity and they knew of magnetism, like these kind of like magical parts
like
of nature.
Figuring out that the same thing.
But then when they figure out that they are different aspects of the same thing, can you imagine that? Can you imagine
that? That wasn't like Tesla. It was way before that.
It was Maxwell.
Yeah. Okay, yeah.
All right. And Evan, you're going to close us out with a quote.
Yes, I am. And here we go. And Kara's going to back me up by telling us who submitted this because I totally forgot.
I forgot too. But somebody on Twitter, he was cool and he was from Oslo.
Yes. Yes, and his name was like 80 characters long.
It was American, for American.
Thank you for sending this. Education, the path from cocky ignorance to miserable uncertainty.
Yep.
Mark Twain.
So
of course.
Of course, right?
So
attributed
Mark Twain.
Attributed to Mark Twain. You couldn't fully confirm it.
We did look into it. Yeah. There didn't seem to be any conflicting reports, but if there is out there, let us know. And one of the many Mark Twain websites out there is carrying that as one of his quotes. So we ran with it.
But there wasn't a reference to a primal source.
I looked for like the book it was written in, or the article, or the notice, and I could not find it.
That's cool. Your goal is to be miserable, which is it's a nice miserable.
It's an easy bar
it's
to hit.
Yeah.
Well, thank you all for joining me for this special episode.
This was a lot of fun. Yeah. We should do this more often.
We should. We should. Well, it's all about getting Kara over to the East Coast. And until next week, this is your Skeptic's Guide to the Universe. Skeptic's Guide to the Universe is produced by SGU Productions, dedicated to promoting science and critical thinking. For more information, visit us at theskepticsguide.org. Send your questions to info@theskepticsguide.org. And if you would like to support the show and all the work that we do, go to patreon.com/skepticsguide and consider becoming a patron and becoming part of the SGU community. Our listeners and supporters are what make SGU possible.